Chapter 13. Virginia Giuffre. Brave Survivor or Jet Set Sex Slavery? The following account is taken from Virginia Giuffre's legal testimony, including her memoir of the events that took place during her time with Epstein. Her Twitter handle is @VRSVVirginia. High on a cocktail of pharmaceuticals and alcohol, the girl wished herself a happy 15th birthday, then climbed onto the balcony railing of the apartment she shared with her 65-year-old abuser and pimp. Looking down at the street far below, the girl thought back on a brief life filled with sexual abuse and suffering, and set her mind on the only path she felt left open to her. Jumping. Such was the 15th birthday of Virginia Roberts, now Giuffre. In many ways, she was the type Epstein preyed upon. Her past of suffering and abuse made her an easy target for further manipulation. As Maria Farmer observed, Epstein and Maxwell would specifically seek out girls with troubled pasts, questioning them on their relationships with their parents and pouncing on the ones who had suffered abuse. In Virginia, they found their perfect prey. The childhood that led up to that balcony railing was one of pitfall after pitfall. At 11 years old, Virginia was sexually abused by a family friend. By 12, she was smoking pot. At 13, she had run away from home and was in and out of the care system. And by 14, she was living on the streets. It was one of those nights, hungry and alone and crying to herself on a street near Miami Beach, that she was picked up by Ron Eppinger. The 65-year-old pulled up in a black stretch limousine and offered her a ride. Sitting with him in the back was a beautiful Czech girl in her late teens wearing a skimpy red mini dress. Eppinger said he was the owner of a modeling agency called Perfect 10. He told Virginia a sob story about how his own teenage daughter had died in a car crash 7 years earlier and how he had never gotten over it. He presented her with a bizarre offer, that he would take her in and she would become his new baby forever. Dazzled and confused, Virginia got in. Eppinger took her for dinner at a local restaurant, then clothes shopping, buying her outfits that should have immediately rung alarm bells, cut off shorts that revealed the curve of her buttocks, skimpy tops and G-strings. After shopping, he took her back to his apartment, a plush property overlooking the sea. The bedroom had a raised circular bed under a mirrored ceiling. Told she would be sharing this room with Eppinger himself, she was then introduced to five beautiful girls, all in their late teens and from the Czech Republic. The girls shared a room at the other end of the apartment and were all lounging around naked or wearing just G-strings. If the penny hadn't already dropped, it did now. She found out that Eppinger's model agency was really an international sex trafficking ring and high-end escort agency. The girls were hired out to rich clients for more than $1,000 an hour and trained to satisfy every possible sexual desire. They pretended to enjoy the lifestyle and regaled Virginia with stories of their exploits with rich clients, while they combed and styled her hair and nicknamed her Baby. Soon, Eppinger reappeared and took Virginia to the bathroom, where he gave her two blue pills, which he said would help her relax. He then took her clothes off and sexually assaulted her for the first of many times. Virginia was quickly introduced to the lifestyle, lazing around with the girls in the day, having laser hair removal treatment, waxes and tanning sessions, then at night attending lavish parties where the girls would flirt with potential clients before accompanying them home. Eppinger always kept Virginia for his own use. but she was forced to partake in orgies with the other girls as a kind of training, where she would learn sexual techniques to keep men happy. Eppinger would drive her around topless in his open-top convertible, carelessly showing off the 14-year-old as his latest possession. Several weeks of this lifestyle took its toll, and by her 15th birthday, Virginia found herself on the balcony of Eppinger's apartment, balancing on the rail and looking down toward the potential release of death. But it wasn't to be. As she contemplated the drop, the door slammed open, and Eppinger grabbed her, pulling her back into the apartment. He gave her 3 pink pills to swallow, and she sank quickly into unconsciousness. The routine of abuse continued, but Eppinger's carelessness was beginning to expose him. Someone seeing him parading Virginia around topless had reported him to the police. In a panic, he cleared out of the Miami apartment and fled with all the girls to a remote ranch in the Florida countryside. Here, Virginia began to enjoy life a little again, spending time on her own, writing in her journal, painting and spending time with the horses, her favourite pastime since early childhood. Feeling increasingly isolated, she began using one of the ranch phones to call her childhood friend and first crush, Tony Figueroa. Tony told her how worried her parents were and that they had hired a private investigator to search for her. Although it was risky, she began to call Tony regularly, creeping into the same unused guest room to whisper furtively down the line and listen eagerly to news from home. It was a mistake. Eppinger soon found out. He was tipped off by the housekeeper that Virginia had been using one of the guest bedrooms regularly, but that the sheets were never messed up. Eppinger checked the telephone bill and found the same number was being called regularly from the room. Furious, he gave her 5 minutes to pack her few possessions before she was kicked out. A driver arrived precisely 5 minutes later. She was being taken away, Eppinger shouted, to another man, another owner who, he promised, was not as nice as himself. She threw a few clothes into a bag and hid some $100 bills she had been saving inside her scrunchie. Then she was inside the car and speeding away toward the next nightmare. Charlie had an apartment in downtown Miami. He was a 40-something businessman who owned a restaurant nightclub in Fort Lauderdale. The first night Virginia stayed with him, he took her out drinking and dancing at his club. Afterwards, at his apartment, he sexually abused and raped her. Over the next few weeks, he kept her by his side day and night so that she had no chance to call Tony, even if she had found the courage to do so. Fortunately, she was soon rescued from the stifling grip of her new abuser, and it was Tony she could thank. One morning she was woken by the sound of the door being smashed open. FBI agents in black military outfits burst into the room and arrested the still-naked Charlie, dragging him off in handcuffs while he screamed threats to Virginia to stay quiet. Taken to the police station, she was informed that Tony had told her parents about his phone calls with Virginia. They had informed the police, and the FBI had been tapping Eppinger's phones ever since. They had followed her from his countryside ranch and been keeping tabs on her until the raid. Unfortunately, Eppinger himself got news of Charlie's arrest and fled the country to Eastern Europe, where he managed to live a few more years of freedom before being arrested and extradited back to the US. He was sentenced to a hefty prison term, but being then in his mid-70s, he died just 1 year into his sentence. Virginia was met at the police station by her father. He said her mother wouldn't allow her back to the family home, so she'd have to return to the care facility she had escaped from before. Her father promised to find her someone to stay with, and a place back in school. But Virginia didn't trust him. She gave him 1 week to make good on his offer, after which she promised to escape again, and this time for good. A week came and went in the facility with no word from her father. So, true to her promise, she escaped, slipping the grip of her inexperienced driver on a trip for a routine drugs test. She bought herself some new clothes to disguise her identity, then called her father from a payphone. He assured her that he had found a suitable family for her, and that he was just trying to convince her mother to sign the papers to let her out. He persuaded her to come home to speak to her mother, and she reluctantly agreed. Back at the house in Palm Beach County, there was an emotional reunion with her mother that began with anger and ended in tears. With the air cleared, her mother asked her to rejoin the family, and Virginia agreed. She would go back to school, and in the meantime get a summer job working at Donald Trump's luxury resort, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, where her father worked as an engineer. She would study and work hard with the ultimate goal of becoming a qualified massage therapist, her dream job. Perhaps, Virginia dreamed, even after everything she had been through, she could go back to the normal life of a teenager. Little did she know that the job at Mar-a-Lago would be the stepping stone to her worst nightmare yet. She began working as a locker room attendant at Mar-a-Lago Spa. One afternoon, she was enjoying a break from work, sitting on the lawn under the summer sun, reading a book about anatomy, when she was approached by a slim, elegant-looking woman with short, dark hair. In a perfect English accent, the woman introduced herself as Ghislaine Maxwell and politely inquired about Virginia's reading material. Virginia said that she hoped to become a massage therapist, and Maxwell offered to introduce her to the wealthy businessman she worked for. Virginia at first declined, saying she didn't have any experience or training. But Maxwell said if he liked her, her boss would get her the best training money could buy. Excited, Virginia agreed to come meet the businessman at his mansion in Palm Beach. Her slide into Epstein's orbit had begun. The next afternoon, her dad drove her to Epstein's mansion on El Brillo Way, one of Palm Beach's most sought-after addresses. Maxwell met them at the entrance and escorted Virginia upstairs, leaving her father to drive home. Maxwell led Virginia through the opulence of the Palm Beach mansion, past crystal chandeliers and dozens of pictures of nude and semi-nude young women. At the top of the stairs, Maxwell took her through a bedroom with a king-size bed and into a massage room, which compared to the Mar-a-Lago spa in its lavishness with marble walls and glass-enclosed shower cubicle. In the middle of the room, lying on his front, was a naked man. Virginia felt a stab of unease, but told herself this was what she would have to get used to if she were to become a professional masseuse. Epstein angled his head around and introduced himself, smiling knowingly to Maxwell, who proceeded to instruct Virginia on how to massage him. Taking a foot each, Virginia mirrored Maxwell's movements, pushing the blood up his calves and into his legs, as the two asked questions about her life. Virginia told them the truth about her unfortunate past, but to her surprise, instead of responding with horror, as most people did, they probed her as much as possible on all the terrible experiences she had undergone, even seeming to be entertained by the stories. Epstein called her a naughty girl, smiling wryly. Virginia responded, "No, I'm not. I'm really a good girl, just always in the wrong places." "It's okay," said Epstein, turning over to expose his erect penis. I like naughty girls. Virginia tried to hide her shock by concentrating on the massage, but now Maxwell was behind her with her top off. She quickly began unbuttoning Virginia's top and took off her bra, cupping her bare breasts and licking her nipples. She then undressed Virginia completely, pausing only to share a laugh with Epstein about Virginia's young, girlish panties. Still in a whirl of shock, Virginia was instructed to lick Epstein's nipples, then to give him oral sex. All the time, an oppressive feeling was settling on her, that this was what was meant for her in life, that there was no escape from this kind of sexual abuse, and she might as well just accept her fate. Her fears were confirmed as Maxwell instructed her to finish the massage by straddling Epstein's penis. When it was all over, she went to the sauna with Epstein, where he told her about his past and his meteoric rise from high school teacher to millionaire financier, while Virginia listened politely. She was quickly learning to play the role of a student to his wise and knowledgeable teacher, in order to massage his ego as well as his body. Afterwards, they took a shower together. But rather than being an intimate occasion, Virginia was shocked to be asked to wash his feet and body, and to even shampoo his hair. After toweling him dry, she was accompanied downstairs, where Maxwell was waiting. The older woman complimented her on her performance and asked her to come back at the same time the following day. Epstein then opened a bag stuffed with $100 bills and handed two to Virginia, joking that this was nearly her whole week's wages at Mar-a-Lago. With that, the interview was over, and Virginia was driven home, where she took another shower and tried, unsuccessfully, to scrub the memories from her body. The next day, Virginia went to work at Mar-a-Lago as usual. All day she worried about the evening ahead, but she managed to convince herself that this was her life now, and that she had to grow up from a naive teenager to a mature young woman if she ever wanted to achieve her goals. When the workday ended, she found herself standing before the large double doors of Epstein's mansion again. He was waiting for her as before, and events proceeded in much the same way, with Maxwell instructing her until Epstein could control himself no longer, and the massage turned into a threesome. The next day was the same routine again, except Virginia was expected to satisfy Epstein on her own without Maxwell's instructions. It seemed that she had made the cut and passed Epstein's sordid work trial. The next week, she was expected at the mansion every evening after work, and soon found herself exhausted, yet unable to sleep, each night going over in her mind the sickening images from just hours earlier. Sometimes the sessions would only involve Virginia and Epstein, while other times Maxwell would join in, and sometimes Maxwell's assistant, Emmy, would also be involved. Emmy was a young, attractive English woman with blonde hair and striking eyes. The women would be expected to perform lesbian acts on each other, to get Epstein aroused, before satisfying his desires in whatever manner he chose. After it was over, everyone would get dressed and go about their business like a normal day. Before one session, Virginia was invited onto a balcony for a smoke with Maxwell and Emmy. She found herself having a nice chat and a laugh with the two older women. It was like an everyday cigarette break at any workplace around the world, except for the task they were about to get back to. Virginia's compliance to Epstein's whims had clearly gone down well, because it wasn't long before he asked her to quit Mar-a-Lago and work for him full-time. She would be paid $200 per massage, of which there might be as many as 3 a day, and would accompany him on his private jet to his many residences, both at home and around the world. She accepted, knowing what the job would really entail, but was still telling herself the lie that this was the fast track to the life she always wanted. The next day, instead of Mar-a-Lago, her father dropped her off at Epstein's mansion. She hugged her dad goodbye and felt the last of her innocence wash down the drain as she turned to enter the house. Later that same day, she found herself with the pilot in the cockpit of Epstein's private 727, rushing with adrenaline as she watched the jet take off and head north towards New York. Minutes later, she was brought back down to Earth, as she was ushered into the back to give Epstein a massage. This contrast of jet-set glamour and sordid slavery would characterize the rest of her time with Epstein and Maxwell. Virginia was suitably wowed by the East 71st Street mansion in New York with its opulent, eccentric decor, its medieval tapestries, dark corridors and hidden stairways. She noticed the many pictures of naked and half-naked young women, some photos of Epstein with famous celebrities and politicians, even one with the financier with his arm around the Dalai Lama, and a statue of the horny goat god Pan, which Virginia thought particularly appropriate. It was soon down to business, though, and she was escorted, via an elaborately styled lift, downstairs into the black marble darkness of the steam room and massage area that she would later come to call the dungeon. The massage ended in the predictable way, and afterwards Virginia was directed to her room, a plush loft space with a king-size bed and more medieval tapestries decorating the walls. Virginia hardly had time to take in her surroundings and test the bed before being summoned on the intercom to Epstein's office. She was surprised to be told she could spend the day shopping and sightseeing, and was given several $100 to entertain herself. She bought a disposable camera and spent the rest of the day taking snaps of the various sites. When she returned to the mansion, she was reprimanded by Maxwell for staying out too long. The next day, Maxwell bought her a cell phone so she could keep tabs on her and summon her home to satisfy Epstein at a moment's notice. Virginia kept her trips to the city shorter, but they remained the highlight of her day. It was now that the job took on a new twist. Epstein told her he would pay her double if she began recruiting women off the street to join in her massages. Virginia reluctantly agreed, feeling she had to go along with anything asked of her. Epstein explained that she should use her charm to get chatting to the kind of girl he liked. Young, blonde, blue eyes, uniquely gorgeous, but no African Americans, before using his money and contacts in the acting and modelling world to entice them back to his mansion. She complied, but already the strains of the role were beginning to tell on her. When they flew back to Palm Beach, she saw a doctor and got a prescription for an anti-anxiety medication called Xanax. She took the pills before encounters with Epstein or his friends in order to get her through the degrading experiences she was forced to suffer. Her 17th birthday was spent on Epstein's Caribbean island of Little St. James. As a present, she was given a new set of designer makeup. When she blew the 17 candles out on her cake, Maxwell joked that she'd soon be too old for Epstein's tastes. A few days later, a beautiful young woman named Sarah Callan arrived on the island. A few years Virginia's senior, with ash blonde hair and large brown eyes, it was clear she had been Epstein's toy in the past. She was now living in LA, trying to start up an acting career with Epstein's help, and had flown to the island for a short break. Sarah lounged naked around the pool, and would tease Epstein for sex. Epstein told Virginia that Sarah was one of the best he'd ever had for procuring young girls. And when it came time to entertain Epstein in tandem with Sarah, it became clear her expertise extended to all areas of the role. On Sarah's last night, they all took a stroll on neighbouring St. James Island. As the evening progressed, Epstein suggested that Sarah and Virginia go to a local nightclub to see if they could procure any girls. Suddenly it dawned on Virginia the nature of Sarah's trip to the island. She was there to instruct Virginia in her new role as procurer. That night they didn't find any suitable candidates, but Virginia learned much about the dark arts of her new job by the cool, confident way that Sarah approached girls and flitted from group to group. Despite her qualms, Virginia soon became accustomed to the new role and began introducing girls to Epstein, just as has happened with her. She would lure them to the house with the promise of easy money and then instruct them how to massage. At some point, Epstein would tell them to get undressed, and if the girl complied, Epstein knew he could get away with whatever else he wanted, which might include lesbian acts between the girl and Virginia, and manual or oral or full penetrative sex. The girl would receive $200, and Virginia $400. To mark her upgraded status, Epstein now rented apartments for Virginia in Palm Beach and New York. Virginia began to increase her intake of Xanax and added ecstasy and LSD to her growing list of recreational drugs. She was partying hard in her downtime, and even recruited some of her friends to help satisfy Epstein's needs. Her life was spiraling out of control. She needed some form of stability, and the chance came with the return of her one-time rescuer and childhood crush. Tony knocked on the door of her Palm Beach apartment one day, saying he'd found her address from mutual friends and had been knocking randomly on her door ever since. The two quickly fell into a relationship, and Tony moved secretly into the apartment with her. Feeling guilty about her deception, Virginia tentatively raised the subject of Tony with Epstein during a massage. She was surprised at his reaction. No jealousy or rage, just amusement that she would even think that he'd be bothered. "No one in this world is monogamous," said Epstein, laughing. "Why would I expect you to be?" Epstein started providing her with massage training from professional therapists, and Virginia soaked up the knowledge, daring to think again that her career goals would be achieved through Epstein. But her hopes were smashed when the real reason for the extra training became clear. Epstein intended to farm her out to other clients. The call came direct to her Palm Beach apartment. Epstein wanted her to visit the exclusive Breaker Hotel that night to massage his two friends, a married couple called Glenn Dubin and Eva Anderson Dubin. Eva was an ex-girlfriend of Epstein's, a doctor and former Miss Sweden. Glenn was a billionaire hedge fund manager. Virginia was worried to hear that Eva was heavily pregnant, as her training didn't qualify her for that. However, Epstein encouraged her to just make Eva comfortable and do what she asked, as the real client was going to be Glenn. That's when it dawned on her what the visit was really all about. She entered the hotel with a heavy heart and found the couple's apartment. She was escorted to the bedroom where she was asked to massage Eva. She did so to the best of her ability, even massaging the woman's swollen breasts to help ease their soreness. When Eva was relaxed enough to sleep, Virginia turned out the light and went to find her next client, the husband. Glenn was in the lounge, waiting with the lights dimmed. Her worst fears were confirmed when he undressed and laid on the floor on his back, exposing his penis. Hoping to delay the inevitable, Virginia instructed him to turn over and began going about the task of a regular massage. After a couple of hours of hard work, Dubin asked her to remove her top. She complied. Soon, she was completely naked and responding to more of his requests. Finally, he had sex with her while his pregnant wife slept in the other room. When it was done, he coolly got dressed and tipped Virginia before sending her off into the night, feeling more like a prostitute than she ever had before. 2 days later, Virginia flew with Epstein to his El Zorro ranch in New Mexico. With its indoor pool and gym, its fake western town, and thousands of acres of land to explore on horseback or quad bike, this was Virginia's favourite property. She flew in with Epstein, Maxwell, and Emmy, and the four of them went on a sightseeing and shopping trip in nearby Santa Fe. Returning home, she was required to give Epstein a massage. Then the dysfunctional family watched a film together in the movie room while Virginia and Emmy massaged Epstein's feet. The night's entertainment concluded with a foursome before bedtime. Virginia retreated to her room to call Tony for some comfort, only to find he was off his head as usual with a group of friends at her apartment, no doubt trashing the place. Since moving in, Tony had refused to get a job and had sponged off Virginia's earnings from Epstein, using them to fund his ever-increasing drug habit. The next day, Virginia flew alone with Epstein to Carmel in California, while Maxwell and Emmy headed back to New York. Epstein gave Virginia some money to go shopping while he attended a conference. In town, Virginia met a carefree and pretty California girl who was on a road trip. Always on duty, she decided to ask the girl if she wanted to make some extra money, giving a rich client a massage. The girl seemed keen, even when Virginia admitted the massage would have to be naked and would probably involve more than just the relaxing of muscles. Virginia planned to meet up with her later and headed back to the apartment. Epstein was tired from the day, but Virginia persuaded him to come out to a restaurant. Then, when they returned to the apartment, she secretly let her new friend in while Epstein was showering. When he was done, he came into Virginia's room, only to see a strange and naked young girl in the bath. The girl stood up, letting the bubbles slowly run down her naked body, and Epstein smiled his approval. The two girls then massaged Epstein with the predictable results. Afterwards, the girl was paid the usual $200, and her name was entered into the little black book in which Epstein recorded the contact details of all his best encounters for future reference. The following day, after lunch, Virginia and Epstein flew to Los Angeles. On the private jet was a surprising guest, Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. As a massive fan, Virginia fired questions at him about the inspiration for The Simpsons, and was told it was based on Groening's own family upbringing. Less palatable than the conversation was when Epstein asked Virginia to give the cartoonist a foot massage, and she saw the state of his feet. They were oddly shaped, with long, hardened yellow toenails and bits of sock fluff still stuck to his sweaty toes. Virginia couldn't bear to do the massage without first cleaning Groening's feet with a wet towel. The cartoonist didn't seem to mind, however, and he gave her two hand-drawn sketches of Homer and Bart with personal messages on them. In L.A., they met up with Sarah Kellen and another of Epstein's girls, Nadia Björling, a Swedish model, singer and actress who would soon go on to star in the soap opera Days of Our Lives. Nadia had brown hair and shocking blue eyes, and was one of the most beautiful women Virginia had ever seen. They all went back to the apartment that Epstein rented for Sarah on Malibu Beach, where five more young women were waiting. Sarah had provided a wide range of choices for Epstein's pleasure. However, bored and annoyed by the female conversation, Epstein took just Virginia and Nadia to the room next door, where he instructed them to use sex toys on each other while he penetrated each of them in turn. Virginia felt even more degraded than usual, hearing the babble from the other room fade to silence as the girls listened in, knowing full well what was happening in the room next door. Virginia and Epstein flew back to New York later that evening, and Virginia returned late to her New York apartment, just in time to find Tony having sex with another woman. In a rage, she threw them out, aware, even as she did so, the hypocrisy of the situation. She was, after all, spending most of her time with another man. When Virginia told Epstein about her boyfriend's infidelity, he didn't commiserate or console her, but laughed it off, asking, what did she expect? Men were incapable of being loyal, said Epstein, playing his favourite role, the mentor. If she just remembered that one fact, she would never be hurt again. It was hardly what a young, heartbroken girl wanted to hear. And Virginia went home, feeling worse than ever. The spat with Tony didn't last long, and he soon moved back into Virginia's Palm Beach apartment. Two nights before flying back to New York to be with Epstein, Virginia threw a lavish party for all her friends at a hotel on Singer Island near Palm Beach. With her newfound wealth, she provided a cocktail of drugs for all the partygoers, and they stayed up into the early hours of the next morning. The next day on the flight to New York, Virginia felt terrible and put it down to a prolonged drug comedown. When she arrived at the 71st Street mansion, she started sweating uncontrollably and had to run to the bathroom to be sick. Later, when Epstein called for his massage, she had to refuse for the first time. She was having intense stomach cramps and put it down to something she'd eaten on the plane. She managed to get some sleep, but when she woke up, she found the sheets drenched in her own blood. Gasping with pain and vomiting, she managed to grab the phone and call the housemaid. Maxwell was soon in the room and called for Epstein. The housemaid helped her downstairs where Jojo the driver was waiting, and Epstein and Maxwell accompanied her to the hospital. Inside the ward, she was given a pain-killing shot and quickly fell into unconsciousness. When she woke, a doctor informed her that she'd had a miscarriage. Epstein took the doctor aside for a private chat before taking Virginia home. He spent no energy on trying to comfort her, but he did pay the medical bills, the least he could do, considering the unborn child was almost certainly his. She was given 2 weeks off following the miscarriage, time she spent in her Palm Beach apartment self-medicating and sinking into a deep depression over the state of her life. But there was to be little respite. When the fortnight was up, Epstein called her with a new task, to keep a friend of his company on a trip to Little St. James. The role would require occasional massages and to keep the guest happy. No more needed to be said. She packed a suitcase and jetted off to the island to meet a Harvard professor called Stephen, with white hair and a mad professor look. Virginia showed Stephen around the island on quad bikes, then took him back to freshen up before dinner. Over food and wine, the professor began to lose his awkward mannerisms and loosen up. He even plucked up the courage to ask for one of the wonderful massages Epstein had been telling him about. Virginia downed 2 Xanax to ease the process, then went about her business as deftly and professionally as she had come to learn. Massaging the aging man, then having sex. The next day, she gave him another massage at the beach, and they swam out to a water trampoline. In the evening, they had dinner and more wine, but when Virginia asked if he required another massage, he demurred, saying he just wanted to stay up watching movies. Surprised, but not disappointed, Virginia went to bed. Stephen had been only her second client, other than Epstein, but already it was beginning to feel worryingly normal. When the trip was over, Epstein invited her to New York to pick up her pay for the job with Stephen. When she arrived, she noticed another girl hanging around the mansion. She was called Rena, a teenage artist of Asian descent. Two things quickly became apparent to Virginia. Rena and Epstein had already had sex, and Epstein was using promises of selling her artwork to get her under his spell. Epstein soon asked Virginia for a massage, but this time Rena was to be present too. The three took a shower, then moved to the dungeon. Things seemed to be going normally, with Rena copying Virginia's instructions, until Epstein rose from the massage table and asked Virginia to lie down instead. Shocked, she complied, wondering what was going to happen next. She soon found out when Rena started hitting and whipping her, subjecting her to an hour of bondage for Epstein's pleasure. Rena was a dominatrix, and soon became a fixture around the Manhattan mansion, with Epstein even renting her an apartment. Rena and Virginia's double act soon became a favourite, with the artist using all kinds of toys and weapons on her lowly assistant, even cutting her and striking her around the mouth. Virginia soon learned to get her own back, however, domineering Rena during sex acts until the sessions became like competitions, with both girls striving for mastery over the other, all of which just seemed to excite Epstein further. Apart from her proclivities in the bedroom, Rena was a talented artist and made a painting of her and Virginia lying naked in the yin-yang position. Epstein was thrilled with the work and, as thanks, got her an exhibit in New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. But Virginia was getting tired of the physical violence, and Epstein was also going off the young artist. Rena was becoming clingy and jealous, asking why she couldn't come on the longer trips with Epstein that Virginia was entitled to. It was a step too far. Emotional attachment was the one thing Epstein didn't want from his girls, and Rena was soon left by the wayside. Virginia couldn't say she was sorry. One day in New York, Epstein gave Virginia $1,000 to buy new clothes and get her hair restyled at one of New York's most exclusive beauty salons. She was also tasked with obtaining two ID photos of herself. The mystery of what this was all about was resolved when Virginia returned from her shopping trip and Epstein told her they would be flying to Europe for a special occasion. They would be attending supermodel Naomi Campbell's birthday. They set off in April, stopping first in London, then Paris, and finally landing in Saint-Tropez, the Mediterranean playground of the rich and famous. They met Naomi Campbell in the famous Nikki Beach Club, where the supermodel was sipping champagne, surrounded by acolytes. She spoke briefly with Epstein and Maxwell, and invited them to a party on a private yacht, before the main event that evening. Dressed in her new ball gown and refreshed after drinking in the Mediterranean sun, Virginia drank expensive champagne and was introduced to a steady stream of rich and important people. Epstein appeared to be showing her off to his rich friends, and that too felt good. She continued to drink and dance with several men, even a prince, as Epstein later informed her. The whole evening was a heady mix of alcohol, dancing and socialising that left her feeling dizzy and high on life. But the come-down was quick to follow. In the car back to the hotel, there was another passenger, a fat and balding middle-aged man. He was introduced as Rick and was one of the Hilton hotel-owning dynasty, according to Epstein. Virginia was required to accompany him back to his room and give him a massage, with all that entailed. Back in Rick's room, She attempted to keep the encounter to a professional massage. But Rick persisted, unzipping her dress, then trying to take off her underwear while she attempted to rub his body. Disgusted and drunk, she decided to cut the encounter as short as possible, giving the drunken millionaire oral sex that was mercifully quick. Feeling as degraded as she had high earlier in the evening, she rushed back to Epstein's room, where the financier gave her a comforting hug. But the sympathy didn't last long. Epstein required his own massage before going to bed. She celebrated her 18th birthday in New York and was given a pair of diamond earrings by Epstein. They flew to Little St. James, where Ghislaine, who had recently acquired her helicopter pilot's license, took them to neighbouring St. John. Here, they picked up Alexandra Cousteau, the granddaughter of the underwater explorer Jacques Cousteau. Virginia was tasked with supplying Cousteau with massages, which, for once, were not sexual. However, on Epstein's instigation, Virginia and Cousteau were instructed to play out lesbian scenes for the financier. Virginia was shocked to discover that someone so high profile could be so easily dragged into Epstein's sordid games, but she soon found out that he was providing funding for Cousteau's underwater project. It wasn't just girls off the street, it seemed, who could fall under Epstein's spell. With Cousteau around, the group did a lot of scuba diving, exploring the reefs around the neighbouring island. On one occasion, they went out of their comfort zones, stumbling into the breeding grounds of some hammerhead sharks. Spotting the deadly shadows swimming towards them in the water, the group had to head to the surface as quickly as possible before scrambling back onto the boat. Virginia was the second from last to be pulled onto the boat as the shark swam closer. Epstein, of course, was the first. She spent Christmas and New Year with Epstein in New York, then accompanied him to Paris, where they stayed in a hotel overlooking the Champs-Élysées. Epstein was overseeing the construction of his new Paris apartment and seemed to revel in his power in front of the builders, bossing them around and insisting they change the smallest of details at the last minute. From Paris, they flew to Spain and on to Tangier, where they stayed in a 5-star hotel on the edge of the Moroccan city. In between massaging Epstein and visiting the sites, Virginia spent her time strolling through the local bazaars, taking in the culture and heartbeat of the city. After several days, they flew to England and spent the night in Maxwell's townhouse in London's wealthy Belgravia district. The next morning, Virginia was woken by Maxwell entering her room, announcing breezily that they had a busy day in front of them. They would both be going shopping for new clothes and accessories, as that night they would be meeting someone very special, a royal prince, no less. Virginia was slightly disappointed to find out it was Andrew, the Duke of York, rather than one of the younger generation, but managed to hide it well enough. The rest of the day was spent hurrying around London's designer boutiques, until Virginia had 3 new outfits to choose from for the evening ahead. After much deliberating, she went for the simplest, a pink mini tee and a pair of jeans. When the prince arrived, Virginia was feeling nervous. She listened politely as the 3 friends criticised Andrew's recently divorced ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson. Then the attention turned to her. Ghislaine asked Andrew how old he thought she was, and the prince guessed correctly. Ghislaine laughed and said, "I guess we're going to have to trade you in soon," making light of Epstein's preference for underage girls. The 4 ate at a restaurant, then went on to Tramp Nightclub, an exclusive members-only club in Mayfair. Epstein took a seat while the others danced. Andrew soon had his hands on Virginia and was whispering compliments in her ear while she laughed, embarrassedly. When she stole glances at Epstein and Maxwell, They were laughing, enjoying the spectacle of Andrew's terrible dancing and Virginia's discomfort. After an hour of this, and with Andrew drenched in sweat, they returned to Maxwell's townhouse. On the taxi ride home, Maxwell made it clear that Virginia would be expected to make Andrew happy, the same way she did with Epstein. Part of Virginia was shocked at this, naively expecting better of royalty. But another part of her was already resigned. Upstairs, Virginia requested the now famous photo of her and Andrew with the prince's arm around her waist and Maxwell hovering in the background. Epstein took the photo with Virginia's camera and disappeared downstairs with Maxwell, leaving Virginia and the prince alone. Virginia ran a bath and undressed. Andrew, it turned out, had a foot fetish, kissing and licking her toes and the arches of her feet. Then they moved to the bedroom, where they had sex. She described it as the longest 10 minutes of her life. The next day they flew back to New York. Elated at returning to normality, she called Tony to meet her at the airport, so they could spend the evening together. However, reality crashed in on her plans. Epstein wanted a massage back at his place when they arrived. She was forced to cancel the evening with her boyfriend and sell her body to Epstein instead. He paid her well for the Andrew encounter, but over the next few weeks, she spent it all on parties, alcohol, and drugs. She was gradually desensitizing herself to the life she was being forced to lead. She didn't meet Andrew again until the following spring in New York. Mooching in her palatial bedroom, waiting for the next summons from Epstein, she received a call to meet him in his study. Taking the elevator down, she was surprised to see Andrew beaming at her from the couch. Maxwell led her to the sofa and sat her on Andrew's lap. The prince had a spitting image puppet of himself, which he was joking around with. He used it to grope Virginia's breasts, which she obediently giggled at. Then he did the same with Joanna Schoberg, another of Epstein's personal assistants, while the two girls posed with him for a picture. Virginia was asked to show Andrew to the dungeon for a massage. It began with a foot massage, but quickly turned into oral sex, with classical music playing in the background and the yin-yang painting of her and Rena looming heavily above Virginia's head. The second meeting with the prince only deepened Virginia's growing depression, and she sank further into drug use, partying so much that she had permanent dark rings under her eyes and her bones were beginning to protrude. Epstein had clearly noticed the change and didn't approve. One day, it came out of the blue. Epstein told her that she no longer looked like the girl he had first met and felt she needed a break. She was dismissed from all further duties. "I'll call you next time I'm in town," he said. And that was the last she heard from him for several months. Back in Palm Beach, Virginia found herself a job as a waitress. The money wasn't even a fraction of what she had earned with Epstein, but she was living her own life, and she quickly started to feel happier and healthier, enrolling on a yoga course and kicking Tony out of the apartment after he had started to become abusive on his continued spiral into drug use. 3 months went by, and Virginia was feeling better than ever. She'd bought a dog and was seeing her family regularly again. But it wasn't long before the bad men in her life were back on the scene. First, it was Tony, banging on her apartment door, high on a cocktail of drugs and screaming down the whole building. She took him inside and soon, more out of pity than love, had agreed to take him back. It was a bad mistake. He was now stealing to fund his habit, and one night he turned up at her restaurant, high, trying to pick a fight with her. She finished her shift early and went out the back to apologize to her manager, leaving Tony slumped alone at the empty bar. On the journey home, he was strangely sullen. He asked to be dropped off at his parents', which Virginia gladly agreed to, driving home alone to fume to herself about his behaviour. The next morning she got a call from her manager demanding angrily where the money was. The tip jar with $150 inside had gone missing the night before. Quickly putting two and two together, Virginia called Tony at his parents' house. But unsurprisingly, he had gone missing and couldn't be contacted. Despite her attempts to explain and offer to pay back the $150 from her wages, the restaurant manager fired her and reported her to the police. With no money coming in and possible prosecution looming, she was in despair. It was just at this point that she got a call from Epstein. He was back in town and wanted to meet for lunch. Seeing a quick fix for her problems, she agreed. They met in his cabana office outdoors by the pool at the El Brillo Way mansion. Epstein asked her if she was off drugs, and in one big rush, she explained about her new healthy and happy lifestyle, how Tony had wrecked it, and the subsequent police investigation. Surprisingly, Epstein was sympathetic and not only offered to take her back, but also to help her with the police. He said he regularly made large monetary donations to the Palm Beach County Police Department and that he could smooth over the trouble she was in. True to Epstein's word, she never again heard from the Palm Beach Police. She went back to her usual role with her master, except now she felt even more indebted to him. His sexual habits hadn't diminished either. If anything, they were more extreme than ever. His taste was ranging towards even younger girls and to orgies involving several girls at a time. Virginia put this down to his newfound friend and business partner, Jean-Luc Brunel. Brunel was a famous French model agent and scout with an equally infamous reputation. He ranged the world looking for the next big stars of the modeling world, usually from the poorest parts of the globe, where he could find young teenagers, 14 to 15 was his preferred age, who would be willing to do almost anything for the bright lights and big money of a modeling career. Anything usually meant sex with Brunel himself, either willingly or with the help of a drug spiked in the victim's drink. Exposed in France, Brunel had fled his home country and was now setting up a company in New York. Epstein invested $1 million in the model agency called MC2, and the two went into a fruitful partnership, with Epstein receiving young girls on tap in return for his funding. With MC2 established in New York, a steady stream of teenage models came and went in Epstein's life. They were mostly from Eastern Europe, Russia, and South America, and many of them spoke no English. They were housed at his brother Mark's East 66th Street apartments and were expected to pose nude, do pornography, and sell their bodies to rich clients. Another job specification was satisfying the increasingly grotesque sexual appetites of Epstein himself, and Virginia, as his travelling sex slave, was expected to participate. She was involved in numerous lesbian orgies with handfuls of other girls while Epstein or some other man watched, usually while masturbating. Around this time, Epstein told her of one of his most degraded exploits involving Brunel. For Epstein's birthday, the Frenchman had given him 3 12-year-old triplets who had massaged, then performed oral sex on the aging financier. As Epstein described the scene, it was clear that he saw it as nothing more than another sexual exploit to brag about. Life with Epstein proceeded as usual, with Virginia studying as much about massage therapy as she could in her spare time. She was becoming a self-taught expert, and Epstein began to enjoy long two-hour sessions with her, which of course always ended in the same abusive way. Her body was still developing, and she was growing from a teenager into a beautiful young woman. She felt that her role with Epstein was subtly changing at the same time. From a pure sex slave to something more like an educated escort, present as much for her charm and conversation as her body. There were fun times too, and sometimes Virginia, Maxwell and Epstein would roll about laughing. But fun could turn into work at any moment, and as soon as Epstein got aroused, the two women would have to flip from enjoying themselves to pleasuring him. Virginia thought of it as a confused family. They did all the things normal families did together, like eating, meals and watching TV. But with the shadow of Epstein's sexual dominance hanging constantly over them. As families went, this was certainly one of the more dysfunctional examples. It was around this time that Virginia first got to see the secret security room inside the New York mansion. She and Epstein were leaving the building one day and heading down the hall towards the massive front entrance. As they passed the rows of disembodied eyes which Epstein used to decorate the walls, he opened a secret door that Virginia had never even noticed before. Following him inside, she saw a bank of around 20 screens showing changing images of almost every view in the house, monitored by a security guard. The rows of eyes and the eerie feeling of being watched wherever she went suddenly made sense. Nowhere in this house was private, she suddenly realized. Everything was captured, and much of it used, for blackmail, pornography, and security. Epstein had all the bases covered. Epstein was now the happy recipient of an ever-increasing stream of young girls from Brunel. They would be sent to him at whichever home he was staying, and were coached to respond to his every sexual whim. There were orgies with as many as 7 girls at a time. But Epstein wasn't satisfied, even now asking Virginia to obtain girls for him as well. To cope with the situation, she started taking Xanax again. Her 19th birthday was spent on the island. There was no party, just a typical family evening spent watching Sex and the City together. Epstein gave her a pair of sapphire and diamond earrings, and Maxwell a designer makeup bag. Some Russian girls arrived on the island, and Epstein and Brunel arranged a model shoot in which Virginia was involved. The girls all had to pose nude and semi-nude in various positions on the beach and draped across the rocks. Then came the inevitable. They were taken to Epstein's cabana, where they engaged in a lesbian orgy for the benefit of Epstein and Brunel, who sat watching and masturbating. "The best part is they don't even speak English, so there's never a need to keep them amused," she heard Epstein say above the mass of tangled limbs. Another time on the island, a similar photo shoot turned into an orgy, with Epstein, Prince Andrew, Virginia alleged in court documents, and 8 young Russian girls. Again, Epstein joked that these were the easiest kind of girls to get on with, because of their lack of English. She needed someone special in her own life again, and the only person she could think to turn to was Tony. She found him staying with one of Palm Beach's most notorious drug dealers. His best friend from childhood, Adam, had recently died in a drug deal gone wrong, and Tony had been hitting the narcotics harder than ever. He could hardly move or respond when she went to collect him from the dealer's house. She had to manhandle him down 3 flights of stairs and into the truck before driving back to her place. Tony was in a worse state than she had expected, so she called all his friends and dealers and asked them not to supply him with drugs while he went cold turkey. Over the next few days, she nursed him through his withdrawal, forcing him out of bed once a day to eat a meal and take a shower, then giving him more of her Xanax to help him slip back into feverish sleep. She was forced to leave Tony while his withdrawal was still in progress, as there were important visitors coming to Little St. James. Al Gore and his wife Tipper were visiting. Unlike all the other men who had come to stay, Gore seemed like an honourable individual. He doted on his wife, and despite the plethora of young women coming and going, his eyes never strayed. Virginia was left with the impression of a man who, were he elected, would look after the country with the same care and respect he did his family. The impression wasn't quite the same with the next political visitor. Bill Clinton arrived on the island and stayed for dinner, eating at the table with Virginia, Epstein, Maxwell and Emmy. The former president had two beautiful women from New York accompanying him, and, after an evening of chatting and joking, he was last seen strolling into the darkness with an arm around each of them. Virginia, of course, retired with Epstein to give him a massage and oral sex, followed by a foot massage to send him to sleep. Back in New York, she began to notice subtle changes taking place in her and Epstein's relationship. One day, after sex, a strand of hair had fallen over her eyes, and Epstein brushed it aside with his fingers. The gesture was oddly tender, and they gazed into each other's eyes with something that came close to intimacy. Afterwards, Epstein wanted to spend the rest of the day with her, just hanging out and having fun together. The relationship continued along this unexpected arc for several weeks. They were spending lots of time alone, time that didn't just involve massages or sex. Watching a movie with the millionaire was more likely to involve snuggling up with a bowl of popcorn than having to kneel at his feet, massaging them like a slave. When they went quad biking at the ranch, Epstein preferred to have her sitting behind him than on a bike of her own. He even tried to teach her how to drive a manual car. And, most welcome of all, she was spared from procuring new girls for him. It seemed Epstein was trying to show her a softer, more caring side of his nature. But why? The answer would come soon, and it was something she could never have expected. It happened on Little St. James. They'd just climbed back onto the dock after a snorkel in the sea. As they were sitting warming their bodies in the Caribbean sun, Epstein shuffled closer to Virginia and put his hand on her back. She knew something was up, but could never have guessed what. Looking sincerely into her eyes, Epstein began to compliment her for her loyalty and told her that she had turned into a charming, funny, and beautiful young woman. As Virginia listened, confused by the unusual outpouring of appreciation, Epstein dropped his bombshell. He wanted Virginia to bear him a child. While Virginia was still reeling over this, Maxwell chipped in hastily with the business side of the proposal. Virginia would receive a large monthly allowance, a mansion in either Palm Beach or New York, and round-the-clock support from nannies. In return, she would have to travel with the child everywhere Epstein wanted them, and would have to sign a contract stating that Epstein had sole custody of the child, should the two fall out. She was reeling, and her maternal instinct kicked in straight away. There was no way she would sign over her baby to the care of this monster, no matter how many dollars or mansions he gave her. At the same time as this realization set in, another part of her knew that it might be dangerous to refuse outright. So she stalled for time, saying she wanted to get her professional massage certificates first and become fully healthy, and then, perhaps in a year, she would be ready to have Epstein's baby. Epstein and Maxwell seemed happy enough with her response, and that night they celebrated over dinner with champagne. On double her usual dose of Xanax and too much champagne, Virginia managed to get through the evening and the subsequent threesome in a state of self-induced numbness. She stumbled back into a normal routine for the next few weeks, and the proposal went unmentioned. Her 20th birthday came about while she was staying in the New York mansion. A buzz came over the intercom while she was painting her toenails in her room. It was Epstein, asking her to come down to his office. When she arrived, he asked her to sit on his lap. He wished her a happy birthday and announced a surprise present. A massage therapy course in Thailand. She would at last get her wish to become a professionally trained masseuse. She was given a week to pack and say her goodbyes. She did the rounds of her friends and family and spent a week getting drunk at farewell parties. Tony accompanied her to the airport and walked with her all the way to the security scanners. He cried when they had to part, not wanting to be without her for so long. Virginia cried too. Her feelings for Tony had diminished over time, but she was still fond of him and felt bad for leaving him just as his recovery from drugs was still in the balance. But this was her dream, and she knew it was time to do something for herself at last. She gave Tony one last hug and turned away, not realizing this would be the last time she would see him. She first flew to New York, where Maxwell had prepared a list of everything Virginia might need in Thailand, from emergency numbers to Western Union locations and a series of do's and don'ts. It was a rare insight into the more caring side of the high society heiress. But when Virginia went to see Epstein, she was surprised to find another woman with him. The beautiful leggy blonde was introduced as Nadia Marcinkova, Epstein's new live-in masseuse, an assistant while Virginia was away. Before she left for Thailand, Virginia was to instruct Nadia on how to massage Epstein as well as on, of course, the seedier aspects of the role. Virginia couldn't help feeling a little hurt at being replaced so easily and callously. But another part of her had expected it. Women were nothing more than tools to Epstein. So why should she be surprised when he would replace an old one so readily? It was amusing to watch how the Czech girl tried to compete with her, trying to massage the boss in her own ways, and melodramatically faking orgasms during their sexual encounters. Virginia tried to brush it all off. She would soon be free from all this, for a short while at least. The last few days in New York sped by, and soon Virginia was touching down in Chiang Mai, the largest city in northern Thailand. She got settled down in her hotel and soon started the course. She was studying 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and partying hard in the evenings. Having so much experience of massage, she quickly became the star of the class and made several friends, one of whom was a girl from Wisconsin who Virginia let share her room as she was beginning to run out of money. It was on one of her many nights out that she met Robbie, an Australian who was training and taking part in the Thai kickboxing tournaments that were big tourist attractions in Chiang Mai. She was instantly attracted to him, and after their first meeting watching a Muay Thai competition with friends, they arranged another date. They quickly fell in love, and she found herself telling him everything about her life of servitude to Epstein. To her surprise, Robbie wasn't judgmental, but rather was sympathetic and comforting. When she told him that they should take it easy because she would have to return soon to Epstein, he asked her to come back to Australia with him instead. They were standing on the balcony of her room overlooking the city of Chiang Mai and the surrounding mountains. "What?" she said, shocked and confused, thinking she had somehow misheard. But she hadn't. Robbie got down on one knee. "Please, will you marry me?" Hardly hearing her own words over her thundering heartbeat, she said yes, and her future was sealed. They were married a little over a week later in a Buddhist ceremony in a mountaintop temple, but not before she had to make the call that she dreaded. Telling Epstein. Her news was met with silence. So nervously, She went on prattling about Robbie and how they had met. Still silence. Worried, she asked Epstein what he thought of the news, and he spoke the last few words she would hear from him for several years. "Have a nice life." Then he hung up. She was upset at first, but with Robbie's help, she put the last of her ties to Epstein behind her. The next day at the ceremony, after the vows, birds were released from a cage. As they watched them flying freely over the mountains of Chiang Mai, she couldn't help but think of the aptness of the symbolism. The two lovers had a 6-week holiday on the island of Koh Samui before heading back to Australia, where Virginia still lives to this day. Over the years, she did her best to forget Epstein and the world she had inhabited. She came off prescription drugs, settled down to family life with Robbie, and gave birth to 2 children. Then one day, out of the blue in 2007, she received a call from Maxwell, asking if she had spoken to the FBI about Epstein. A day later, she got a similar call from Epstein himself, closely followed by one from an FBI agent, informing her that they were investigating Epstein and that she had been identified as one of his victims. Wanting to forget the past, she avoided speaking to the FBI at greater length about her abuse. But 6 months later, when Australian Federal Police turned up on her doorstep, she decided to add her testimony to that of the other survivors. So began a long struggle for justice that continues to this day. In 2009, she brought a civil lawsuit against Epstein for his crimes against her, and in 2011, she told her story to the press, speaking to the Daily Mail, and releasing the damning photograph of her with Prince Andrew at Maxwell's London house. In 2014, she set up her own non-profit organisation, Victims Refuse Silence, with the aim of helping girls escape from sex trafficking and of helping survivors to recover. On Epstein's death, Virginia, like all the other victims, was denied the chance of seeing justice done. But she remains at the front and centre of the battle to bring Maxwell, Jean-Luc Brunel, Prince Andrew and other co-conspirators to justice. With over 100,000 Twitter followers and regularly in the news, she has had a massive influence on keeping the Epstein case in the public eye. Many times on Twitter, she has teamed up with Maria Farmer to expose the super predators. Far from the confused, depressed teenager who was seconds away from throwing herself off that Palm Beach balcony decades ago, Virginia has become an influential woman, leading the fight for justice for survivors of sexual abuse. In the end, she didn't fall, but took flight. And in doing so, she has become a living example of how to transcend victimhood.